Thank you for joining us for our 2020 Annual Business Law Institute. It is important for us to uphold a Polsinelli tradition of providing an innovative CLE program to our clients, general counsel friends, and Polsinelli alumni, and given the circumstances, we are pleased to be able to do so in this virtual setting. During today's webinar, you will be asked to answer a CLE polling question. In order to receive your CLE certificate of attendance, you must answer the polling question. CLE certificates will be emailed within 48 hours after the webinar to all those who answered the polling question. We invite you to participate in today's session by using the Q&A box to submit questions to our speakers or for any technical assistance. If the speakers are unable to answer your question during the live presentation, they will reach out directly after the program. Please visit www.bli.polsinelli.com for additional information, including CLE application statuses, a detailed view of this year's schedule, and more. We look forward to connecting with you throughout the summer and coming back together in person next year. I'd now like to pass it over to my colleagues to kick off today's program.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Jeffrey Bell, and I head up Polsinelli's immigration practice. And for some reason, I was invited to speak about immigration. And usually I don't understand why, because it just doesn't seem that much is going on with immigration. But I'm happy to share a few things with you today. So let's talk about what the administration is doing with respect to immigration. And really this started during the campaign of 2016, where there was a lot of talk during the campaign by President Trump, then candidate Trump, regarding his thoughts on immigration into the United States. There was lots of talk about immigration being too liberal, entry of people into the United States too easy. And really what we've seen over the course of time, over the last 3 years, is that the administration has taken actions with respect to the positions taken during the campaign. And so as we get into 2020, the administration's efforts to limit immigration, I think, have become very clear. And the intent really has been to limit all kinds of immigration into the United States. In terms of how we got here, it really began in 2017 with the administration instituting what was known as the travel ban. The first travel ban began with the looking to prohibit or preclude the entry of certain individuals into the United States. From there, we've moved on to work visa and green card suspensions, which are new. We also have seen over the past year changes to the H-1B visa lottery and system, including financial self-sufficiency requirements for certain individuals seeking entry to the United States or permanent status, and also have seen a whole lot of action and court decision regarding DACA, the deferred action of childhood applicants. And so we're going to talk about all of that as we go through this. But first, let's start with the travel ban. So the administration began with the travel ban in 2017, and it was initially proposed as a ban of individuals from majority Muslim countries coming to the United States. Interestingly, the first ban was premised on the idea of national security, but as the ban was being introduced and then implemented, the president made a significant number of tweets regarding his purpose of the ban, which was to prevent individuals from these majority Muslim countries from entering. So there was at least some thought or some confusion as to what the true purpose of that travel ban was. So initially, 7 countries were included in that ban. It was reduced to 6. The ban was further refined to add some non-Muslim countries, such as North Korea and Venezuela. The travel ban case made its way through the court system, ultimately ending in the Supreme Court in 2018. And in 2018, in a decision authored by Chief Justice Roberts, the travel ban was upheld on the basis that the executive has broad authority with respect to national security, and that would include the entry of individuals into the United States. After that ban, after the court's decision, some further restrictions were introduced for additional countries, some Muslim, some not. But the decision was clear that the administration does have authority with respect to the immigration law and who may or may not be allowed to enter the United States. And so just remember the travel ban decision and Chief Justice authoring it as we move forward, because as we'll talk about later, positions sometimes change. So, from the initial travel ban for national security reasons, we then fast forward to 2020 and the days of COVID. And so when the crisis and the pandemic became noticeable, the administration at the end of January issued an executive order restricting the ability of individuals who had been present in China from entering the United States. And then over the ensuing months, the travel restrictions were added, or travel restrictions were added to include individuals from who had been in Iran, and then extended to individuals present in the Schengen countries, adding the UK and Ireland and ultimately Brazil. And so certainly based on the court's decision in the earlier travel ban case in 2018, it would seem that the executive has the authority to issue these travel restrictions for the basis of national security. Now, what really happens, though, is that because of these travel restrictions, we still have a significant, or what we have is a significant impact on business and business travel. And I'm sure it's impacting a lot of your clients or companies. So individuals from these countries are not allowed to enter the United States on business travel. You have individuals who maybe are employed by U.S. companies or have U.S. work visas that were abroad when the travel ban hit and are unable to enter the United States to resume their work. And so, the impact on business is very difficult due to these travel suspensions, and companies are trying their best to come up with solutions on how they can continue, how can they can manage their business and their employees. The main solution to these current travel bans due to COVID are what we call the third country workaround. And so the ban applies if you've been present in one of the listed countries for 14 days or longer prior to seeking admission to the United States. So a workaround that does work is if you have an employee or individual looking to travel to the United States, if that individual can be resident in a third country for at least 14 days before seeking entry into the United States, the bans do not apply. So when you're looking for strategies to get people into the United States for business purposes, that third country workaround is an option to consider. So in addition to Asia, Europe, we also have travel suspensions on our northern and southern borders. These took effect in March of this year, and initially the borders were closed to anything that was deemed non-essential. In the initial order, specifically exempted were individuals involved in the supply chain. They were allowed to continue to enter the United States, and then kind of a broad category of essential workers were exempted. Those travel restrictions have been extended several times since March of this year and continue to this point. And it's hard to say when the northern and southern borders might reopen. In terms of what's essential, nothing specifically is stated in the order, but individuals have been gaining entry who work in the healthcare space, who work in national security, who work with food, in the food supply chain. But at the end of the day, what we're seeing is that essential is basically whatever the Customs and Border agent determines at that time is essential. So there's a lot of inconsistency at the border. It makes it very difficult for companies to plan on which employees may get into the United States. Certainly makes it hard for business travelers to know if they will or will not get in. And then another thing that we see, which seems strange, the travel is restricted, but we definitely see individuals who are flying into the United States, particularly from Mexico, having a much easier time of being allowed to enter through an airport versus land border driving across the border. And so in terms of strategy, again, something to consider if you have an individual, an employee in Mexico or Canada who normally might drive to the United States, it may be a better idea for that individual to fly. And what we're seeing is that individual will have a better chance of being allowed to enter. So the COVID restrictions continue. So in April of this year, the administration suspended the entry of all individuals, regardless of country, who are seeking an immigrant visa, which means green card status in the United States. And then just a week and a half ago, the administration extended the ban not only for green card entrance, but suspended the entry of individuals on work visas, including the H-1B, L-1, H-2B and J-1, and these bans all remain in effect until December 31st of 2020. What we see is that these bans are not necessarily based on COVID. The idea behind it is explained by the administration is that the COVID harm to the U.S. economy has created a situation of high unemployment, that many of these workers, whether entering for a green card or entering on a work visa, potentially are taking a job away from an American worker. And so the basis underpinning these latest travel suspensions are not national security, but harm to the United States economy by allowing these individuals to enter the United States. And so certainly court cases have already been filed challenging these bans, and it'll be interesting to see if ultimately courts weigh in on whether suspending the entry of individuals with proper status in the United States already is within the executive's purview regarding the immigration law. And so So the difficult part, too, is that we just had the H-1B lottery where you have individuals outside the United States who've been approved for H-1B status who would be applying for their visas to come to the United States to start employment, and they will be suspended from doing so at least through the end of this year and perhaps longer. Interestingly, the ban applies on its face to individuals outside the United States as of the effective date, which is June 24th. And so, we're going to get into some exceptions to the ban as well. So one exception would be is that if an individual is in the United States as of June 24th, the ban does not apply, although I certainly would not recommend an individual travel at any point during this, because even though the ban may not apply, it's hard to predict what a Customs and Border agent is going to say when that individual attempts to return to the United States. So exceptions to the new ban on work visas are pretty limited and really not as generous as what are allowed under the other COVID travel bans. You can see some of the exceptions here. The main ones, I think, that really impact business are if an individual is entering the United States for reasons critical defense or national security, entering because they are involved in the provision of medical care to individuals with COVID and who are hospitalized, not just providing care for COVID necessarily, or involved in medical research to help with COVID. And also those who are necessary to facilitate the immediate and continued economic recovery of the United States, whatever that might mean. So ultimately, I think what we get to is that consular officials, when they are entertaining visa applications to the United States, are going to determine what is in the immediate and continued economic recovery of the United States. And also whether or not a healthcare worker perhaps merits an exception to the ban based on anything to do with COVID. Realistically, there's not a lot of consistency that we're seeing so far, but we definitely are seeing reports of individuals receiving exceptions to the ban, particularly in the healthcare space. So again, the travel bans are going to continue through the end of the year and certainly may be extended. Again, hard to know how quickly lawsuits are going to be decided and whether ultimately can the executive restrict entry for individuals for economic reasons versus national security reasons. And I think that is going to be an interesting question for the courts to decide. There are some additional nuggets in the latest travel suspension, and these things really should give businesses pause. So the order speaks to requesting that the Department of Labor and the Immigration Service, USCIS, investigate and potentially change the permanent labor certification process in the United States. The labor certification process in the United States is a path that employers use to sponsor foreign nationals for permanent status in the United States. The labor certification process currently requires an employer to test the job market to make sure U.S. candidates are not available for positions, but some of the proposals being floated would require employers to do multiple tests of the job market at different times in order to complete the process for a foreign worker. That would absolutely increase the cost, which only makes immigration lawyers happy, but also increase the uncertainty as to whether or not the process is ultimately going to be successful. Similarly, in the executive order, the administration is requesting that the Immigration Service take a look at the H-1B visa program and determine if changes should be made to protect American workers. And so some of the ideas that have been floated involve requiring employers to recruit before they hire an H-1B worker, perhaps only allow H-1B for certain types of occupations or certain education levels. Any of these changes would make the process more cumbersome, more complicated, and much less certain. And from a business standpoint, certainly puts businesses at a disadvantage. The H-1B, as it's constituted now, allows employers to hire talented foreign nationals to help them grow the business without too many roadblocks. And so if any of these proposals come to pass, it certainly could put on end the current H-1B process and make that visa much less attractive. So we're going to turn to the H-1B. So we just had our first year of a new H-1B lottery. So many of you know that the H-1B lottery season has run in early April for the past so many years. Each year, we allow 85,000 H-1B visas, and over the past many years, usually 200,000 to 250,000 applications are filed during the filing period, and a lottery is conducted to select the applications that will be considered. This year, the government went to an electronic lottery system, and I'll give some credit. It basically streamlined the lottery process, I think made it easier for employers to submit lottery requests. It actually reduced the cost for that, so I'll give credit where credit is due. One of the ways that the administration somewhat reformed the H-1B process this year was giving greater preference through the lottery system to foreign nationals with master's or higher degrees. And so certainly something that the administration has talked about before, trying to reserve the H-1B for what in their minds is the best and the brightest, which though doesn't necessarily speak to many other worthy professions that may not necessarily require a four-year or a master's or advanced degree. But again, this year the percentages are way up in terms of lottery winners that have master's or higher degrees. Interestingly enough, during this year and with COVID in place, processing times, if anything, have been faster, not slower. And so, rather than many months to get H-1B decisions for lottery cases, we've seen some within weeks or 30 days. And so certainly something that the administration has given a thought to, and so they've, in terms of processing, the Immigration Service has done a pretty admirable job in the days of COVID in terms of handling those applications. So turning to additional ways that potentially restrict immigration to the United States, the administration earlier this year introduced a financial self-sufficiency requirement for all individuals seeking green cards in the United States. And so under the new rule, applicants for permanent status must be able to provide a certain level of financial self-sufficiency to the Immigration Service, showing that they will not become a public charge and receive public benefits. As part of filing their application for permanent residence, applicants must now complete an 18-page form regarding their financial condition. Believe me, I think you need to be a CPA to file this form or complete this form. It asks a whole host of financial questions, including if the applicant has received any benefits in the United States. As part of the self-sufficiency requirement, applicants must provide their tax returns, a credit report, credit score, and provide evidence of health insurance, or if they do not have health insurance, how they're quickly and reasonably going to get it. The financial self-sufficiency requirement's somewhat interesting because when most applicants apply for permanent residence in the United States, they must have what's called an affidavit of support. An affidavit of support is completed by a sponsor who guarantees that that foreign national is not going to go on public benefits. And so the financial self-sufficiency requirement seems in some cases redundant, because the affidavit of support is supported by financial documentation as well by the sponsor, but the administration is trying hard to make sure only people who are self-sufficient are going to get green cards in the United States. And so certainly people at the lower end on the economic scale are at risk of ultimately being able to become permanent residents in the United States. So that leads us to another potential way of restricting immigration, that's DACA, and I think all of you are aware of what DACA is and who it applies to, and you know, the statistics are about 800,000 are currently in the United States with DACA protection, and many of those individuals have work authorization in the United States. Why it's important to business is that many of those dreamers are working for your company or working for your client's company. Every year, every 2 years, they renew their work permits, they renew their DACA registration, and every time there's talk about terminating or rescinding the program, it draws into question whether or not those individuals will be able to renew their work status. So lawsuits have been going on for years as to whether the DACA program is legal and also as to whether or not the Trump administration can rescind it. So a few weeks ago, the Supreme Court ruled that the stated justification for rescinding DACA as proposed by the Trump administration was not proper, and the court declined to allow the administration to terminate DACA. Interestingly, that decision was written by Chief Justice Roberts, the same decision maker in the travel ban case who granted the executive authority under the law to allow for travel restrictions and travel bans, that, you know, Chief Justice in this case found that the administration had gone too far in terms of its stated rationale for terminating DACA. So DACA is not completely safe, as the administration has said they'll try again to try and terminate it. But certainly that could take years based on the lawsuits that will be filed again. So I have some other potential changes to the immigration law, but before I get to that, this is how quickly things change. 2 days ago, the Trump administration announced that foreign students in the United States whose classes have gone online will now be subject to deportation because they will not be considered maintaining their student status. So think of a school that has set for COVID reasons is moving all of its coursework to online versus in person. A foreign student attending that school will now be subject to deportation because the regulations say that a full slate of online classes is not sufficient for a foreign student to maintain status. So I saw today that Harvard and MIT have already filed a lawsuit against the government to block that. So we'll see. But again, another potential way of trying to restrict immigration. Other things the administration is proposing or is floating, eliminating students' ability to work through curricular practical training, which is part-time work while they attend school, or being allowed to work after they finish school, and also potentially eliminating the STEM OPT extension, which allows 24 more months of work authorization for students with STEM degrees. How that impacts you on this call is that many of those individuals become employees of your company or your client's company when they graduate school. Many of those individuals are allowed to work for 12 months up to 36, who might then be sponsored for an H-1B visa. You know, ultimately, it is going to restrict companies' ability to create a pipeline of talented workers if these foreign students are not allowed to work once they finish school. The administration also is proposing to eliminate work permits for spouses of H-1B workers who've been here for years, also restricting individuals who apply for asylum and their ability to work, and also proposing changes as a whole to the immigration system to make it a more merit-based system rather than family-based. So we'll have to see on all of those. Then really, when all else fails, USCIS is broke. I mean, like really, really broke. They need over $1 billion to fund their operation, and if they don't get it, maybe 70 to 80% of USCIS personnel are going to be furloughed. That means that application processing is going to come to a standstill for businesses looking to obtain work visas or transfer workers from abroad. That maybe isn't going to happen. I know there's a bill introduced in the House of Representatives in the past day or so to provide funding for USCIS, but USCIS is a fee-based organization, not part of the budget. So basically, another way to restrict and limit immigration is by starving the money. So that was quick, and so we do have a CLE question that you need to answer, and hopefully you've been listening. I thought long and hard about this one to make it as difficult as I can. The Trump administration has recently implemented policies to make it easier for foreign nationals to travel and work in the United States. True or false? Has made it easier. So I appreciate all of you on the call, and I certainly appreciate your support of Polsinelli and our virtual BLI. And with that, I would like to turn it over to my partner, Andy Kripe, to kick off the employment section.
Thank you, Jeff. Okay. So obviously, it's been an interesting year in terms of the impact on employment issues due to COVID-19. And what I want to do is just talk about a couple of aspects of the challenging year that we're having both with respect to COVID-19 and the challenging economic situation. And my partners will follow. We're going to offer a little bit more detail and depth on some of these issues. So when we think about what's currently happening, obviously the impact of the pandemic has completely altered the way people have been working in the workplace. And the question that we're dealing with a lot is, what should we be doing? What is the standard of care? What is an employer's responsibility with respect to ensuring that you have a safe workplace? What's an employer's potential exposure? There has been obviously a lack of thorough guidance on this issue. It's something that has been developing based on experience. And I'll just kind of point out a couple of things that I think can help serve as guideposts as you're considering what you should be doing for the remainder of 2020 and in terms of what you may expect beyond that. So first thing that we can safely say is that your actions are going to be judged by reference to what you could do. And it's going to be your actions will be judged with perfect hindsight. In other words, if there is an outbreak in your workplace and you're sued by employees later who claim that you failed to take certain precautions, the jury or the court or the regulators evaluating that claim are going to have perfect hindsight. They're going to be able to second guess. And the thing that they're going to be looking at are basically the standards that have been set up by OSHA and the CDC. And for those of you, if you have not yet reviewed the OSHA Preparing the Workplace Guide, it provides a really useful starting point for evaluating, you know, what you should be doing. And if you're not doing the various things that are on that summary, then you're going to have a challenging time down the road. And hold on one second while I try to advance the slide. Apologies. Okay. 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 So, and I apologize, I am having difficulty actually viewing the slide that is currently up.
Andy, do you want me to advance the slides for you, because I have it up on my screen?
Yeah, if I tell you what, the main problem I'm having is actually seeing what is currently on the screen.
Okay,
I can only see the header.
You just covered workforce considerations, expect the unexpected, and then the next slide is workforce considerations, employee screening issues.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so let's just talk about some of the legal considerations for employee screening issues. Number one, we know that the OSHA general duty to provide a safe workplace standard applies, and that is the thing that you're going to be judged by. Secondly, from a legal standpoint, something that's very helpful, the EEOC has made clear that none of the equal employment opportunity laws will interfere with an employer taking the steps that they need to take to ensure that you have a healthy and safe workplace. As a practical matter, what that means is that you can require daily employee symptom screening. You can require temperature checks. And you can also require viral testing. That is testing to see if an employee currently has the virus. At the same time, though, it's important to distinguish between viral testing and antibody testing. The EEOC has made it clear that you cannot require employees to undergo antibody testing, which is testing that reveals whether somebody has had the virus in the past. The logic behind that is that knowing somebody has had the virus in the past really doesn't provide any meaningful information to ensure a safe and healthy workplace today. And that may change if studies show that antibodies confer immunity, but so far the science is not there. And so the state of the law with the EEOC is that you cannot require antibody testing. You can also not make antibody testing voluntary and have employees share that information with you. That would still be a problem under the Equal Employment Opportunity laws. All right. Thank you. There we go. So what are we seeing in terms of the emerging standard of care? First, as I said, the OSHA Preparing the Workplace Guide is really becoming sort of the definitive Bible in terms of the steps employers should be taking. And if you look at it, you will see that daily self-screening and temperature checks are recommended. And at this point, OSHA is not recommending or requiring that employers conduct virus testing, but that's certainly something that could help. And so when you're looking at those things and you think about returning workers to the workplace, it's obviously that daily self-screening is critical. Likewise, there's a big national discussion about masks. The important thing from the employment perspective is that masks are strongly recommended. In the OSHA guidelines, it's very clear that masks can reduce the emission of respiratory fluids. And so, you know, the policy that we're recommending employers have is that masks be worn whenever social distancing cannot be maintained in the workplace. What that means in a practical sense is that employees walking around the hallways, getting in elevators, or in common spaces should probably be wearing masks unless those spaces are extremely large or outdoors, and spacing is still possible. Some kind of interesting issues that also raises, though, things that are important to remember when you're creating mask policies. You may have an office where people can have private offices, and in that situation, they're maintaining appropriate social distancing. And so, in theory, employees shouldn't have to wear a mask. But here's the caveat that you really need to be careful about, which is that the studies out there are showing that respiratory fluids can linger in the air for between 8 to 14 minutes. So if you have a situation where employees are working without masks in their offices, if another employee comes into someone's office who has not been wearing a mask, they will be exposed to respiratory droplets just as if they'd been standing next to each other without masks. So there's some complicated issues that need to be navigated in policies, and training is really a strong component of all this. And when we think about the emerging standard of care, training is probably the most important part. And that's moving beyond telling people to not touch their face and to frequently wash their hands and to wear a mask, but it's really drilling into the three key infection control strategies, which are time, barriers, and distance. Time, the longer someone is in close contact with somebody, if it's 15 minutes or more, the greater their risk of getting an infection. Distance, obviously, within 6 feet or beyond 6 feet. But the thing to remember about the 6 feet is that just assumes sort of normal interaction, but if the respiratory droplets are aerosolized or blown, the CDC has recognized, and now the World Health Organization has recognized, that you can have a much broader infectious distance. Sneezes can blow droplets up to 27 feet. So that kind of training is really critical. And then the last part is, of course, the importance of barriers. All right, so I'm going to try to advance this. There we go. Okay, so that's sort of the overview with COVID-19 and the emerging standard of care for employees or employers and ensuring a safe workplace. I just want to talk briefly about some of the cost reduction and workforce planning issues that employers are seeing. First, you know, I think it's easiest to talk about this in terms of kind of the do's and the don'ts. The biggest don't or the biggest pitfall in these times are employers that are essentially rushing things, where decisions are being made very quickly and without regard to the consequences. And I want to highlight a couple of issues to think about on that front. One, when it comes to implementing large reductions in force, quickly made decisions can yield disparate impacts. And so now more than ever, it's critically important for employers to continue to perform adverse impact analysis for any reduction decisions to ensure that different groups are not being adversely impacted. Secondly, one of the challenges in the current situation where there's a lot of uncertainty, we're seeing employers implement a variety of incremental measures, sort of one on top of the other, without regard to how these cascading programs relate to or interact with each other. And the challenge that you run into there from a legal perspective is the serious consideration rule, which, so I'll give you just sort of a brief example. Let's say you offer a voluntary separation program. You offer employees the opportunity to resign or to retire in exchange for a separation package. But at the same time, you're contemplating implementing an involuntary reduction program that may provide more generous benefits. Now let's assume employees opt for the less generous voluntary program without knowing that there may be a richer involuntary program down the road. There's a pretty extensive body of case law most of it dates back to the Great Recession, that really raises the question of whether an employer owes some duty, whether it's under ERISA or it's just a fiduciary duty, to let employees know when they're making decisions like whether to accept a voluntary package, they need to provide them all the information that's relevant and meaningful to making that decision. And so if the failure to kind of think through the sequencing of these various cuts can lead to some serious problems down the road, which could either invalidate releases, could entitle employees to claim richer benefits under subsequent programs. And so really thinking through the cascading programs early on is critical to managing that risk. Some other issues that we've been dealing with and seeing a lot of discussion are around are things like salary and pay reductions. Some just quick issues to make sure that they're on everybody's checklist. First, and you know, hopefully this basic principle goes without saying, but you cannot take away accrued pay rights. So people that have accrued pay time off, you can't simply unilaterally reduce those balances. On the next slide, hopefully we'll advance. It is not. I'm sorry, I don't know why this is not advancing. In any event, the thing to watch for, here we go. Okay, are the states that have specific laws dealing with accrued paid time off rights. And there's a list of states there. If you're in one of those states, you want to consult those before making any changes. All right, with that, I'm going to turn it over to my partner, Connie. Connie, thank you for helping me with the slides. Really appreciate it. Connie is in our DC office and can offer more depth and perspective on some of these things.
Thank you so much, Andy, and thank you for calling in from a very remote location where it sounds like it's very, very cold. Andy kind of set the stage in terms of, you know, what he appropriately characterized as the emerging standard of care. And so I wanted to focus a little more on litigation and mitigation of litigation liability. And I want to start the discussion with a quote from a recent decision. And it's an important decision because it's something we probably never would have seen out of a worker safety case. And this was issued on June 24th, 2020. Just a few weeks ago, and this was issued by a judge in Illinois in Cook County, Eve Riley. And she granted an injunction in favor of the employees because the employer had not, who was the franchisee, had not provided appropriate safety measures, including masks and other PPE. And in what I think may have been a twist on the contact tracing standards, said, well, it's okay to not wear a mask as long as when you're 6 feet or less apart, you don't talk for more than 10 minutes. Very much inconsistent with the standards adopted by OSHA and the CDC. And what's interesting about this case is that it's an injunction. It was not barred by workers' compensation. And because of COVID-19 and the prevalence of it and the nature of how it is contracted, the judge ruled that because the workers were not being given sufficient protection in the workplace, that they were potentially exposing not only their families and friends, but also the public at large working at a McDonald's without appropriate protection. So she issued the injunction based on a finding of public nuisance, that the failure to provide appropriate equipment to the workers who interacted with the public created a public nuisance. Now, this kind of turns worker protection litigation kind of on its head. When you look at the potential sources of liability for employees, you've got the existing patchwork of laws, we all know, the ADA, the ADEA, the FMLA. And we also have existing common law theories such as negligence and breach of contract. We have now the overlay of the state and local orders and guidelines that Andy was talking about, and also OSHA, CDC, and other standards that are applicable to employers. And from those, with the unique circumstances of the pandemic, we've seen a surge of litigation on a variety of theories. We've been tracking the litigation across the country, and you can really kind of derive four or five points from it. First of all, I think as the plaintiff's attorneys have geared up for COVID-19 litigation, the cases were a little slow to start, but now are increasing at an exponential rate, COVID-19 itself. And 50% of the cases were filed just in like the last 25 or 30 days. In addition, this is true not only for the individual claims, but also class action. And the claims fit into a couple of different categories. We have classic discrimination issues and retaliation, leave issues like Andy mentioned. In addition, we're seeing a significant amount of claims alleging unsafe work conditions, like the lawsuits, plural, that have been filed against McDonald's. And the class litigation actually tends to focus on either worker safety issues or wage and hour issues. And not surprisingly, the hotbeds for litigation are Florida, California, Texas, New Jersey, and New York. It has taken a minute to advance the slide. In fact, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has said that the specter of this class litigation is possibly the largest area of liability overall for businesses imposed by COVID-19. So let's talk about how things would normally work if we, for a worker safety type claim. So we've got McDonald's workers, they claim that they're not being given sufficient PPE, they're not safe in the workplace. Traditionally, that type of claim would be barred by the workers' compensation exclusivity claim. And so, now we're seeing a surge of litigation. There's a lot of lack of clarity in terms of whether the workers' compensation bar is going to be applicable. The challenge is this is a state law relief system, and the laws vary from state to state, so you're going to get different decisions on the same issue out of different states. And again, from a traditional standpoint, it's not clear that COVID-19 would be a covered occupational injury or illness that would entitle an employee to compensation and medical expense reimbursement under the workers' compensation scheme. In addition, there's severe challenges, as you can imagine, for an employee to prove causation, given the fact that they may have been exposed at work, at school, at home, in the grocery store. It's very, very difficult, particularly with the surge in cases over the last week or so, to try to do that, contact tracing to try to figure out what the source of the COVID-19 exposure may have been. States have stepped into the breach in addressing this causation issue, and they are trying to come up with solutions for how to approach this issue. We have a number of states that have stepped into the breach, and we got a number of different examples that, of how states have approached it, and they're all, of course, approaching it differently. California, for instance, enacted an executive order on May 6th that creates a rebuttable presumption that employees diagnosed with COVID-19 acquire the illness at work if they meet certain timing requirements and they work at a facility as opposed to working from home. In addition, California has three proposed bills that are pending right now that would also offer rebuttable presumptions to certain categories of employees. In Illinois, statute was enacted on June 5th that creates a rebuttable presumption for healthcare workers, first responders, and employees who work for essential businesses who interact with the public. And employers can overcome that presumption by showing compliance to the fullest extent practicable with health and safety practices and guidance. As Andy mentioned, you know, that's the standard of care if you have, for instance, a negligence case, and you have to really be on the cusp in terms of adopting those, not only adopting them, you know, completely, but also kind of towards the leading edge of where we think we're going to be going, for instance, you know, as directed by many states and localities requiring the wearing face masks. Another challenge with workers' compensation exclusivity is that this bar to liability, which limits the employer's liability to the compensation that's available through the state workers' compensation scheme, is you're going to be divided with your carrier because they get the claim in, they deny it unless it's obvious that it's covered, and then they have counsel who represents them in defending the claim. You as the employer, particularly in a class action standpoint where you've had multiple employees who've been exposed in a particular work site, might really embrace the idea of workers' compensation exclusivity, which may prevent a class action lawsuit for negligence, breach of contract, or other tort-based claims or common law-based claims. So you really need to work with your carrier and work within the existing structure within the state to make certain that you maximize workers' compensation availability in order to reduce liability for claims in court. Now, just briefly, you know, the focus here has been on, you know, how do we mitigate liability in this really challenging time with, you know, circumstances that were very difficult for employers and are unprecedented. I think the number one key, as Andy emphasized and you know, I've repeatedly emphasized, is to develop the appropriate procedures and implement the procedures to address the risk of COVID-19, making certain that you're complying to the letter with OSHA, CDC, and state and local orders. One of the focuses of the McDonald's decision on June 24th was the fact that the employer, the franchisee in that case, was not compliant with the state orders or with CDC requirements. But the court actually found that McDonald's itself was not liable for negligence because they had adopted very clear standards that were consistent with the federal, state, and local requirements and had passed that all along in a 59-page instructional pamphlet to franchisees to implement at their location. So, you know, in a franchisee's franchisor situation, where whether it's a parent company with affiliated companies, there's a tension there because you want to follow and you want your affiliates and franchisees to follow the rules. The more you step in, the more you become a joint employer. In addition, you know, Andy mentioned the interplay with EEO and leave laws. It's very important, obviously, to comply with those and to be strategic about complying with those. And make certain that you're careful in responding to employee exposure concerns that arise in order to mitigate that liability and reduce the risk of retaliation. So I'm going to now turn things over to Eric, who's going to talk about another form of litigation liability, which is restrictive covenant liability.
Thanks, Connie. And I'll try to hit the high points because I know we're getting a little short on time. But when COVID first hit, I chair the Restrictive Covenant and Trade Secret Practice Group, and I started thinking about the impact on those, on restrictive covenants. And I think there's an impact that there's a lot going on and we may not be thinking about this part of it, but I started predicting what one of the big impacts would be, and the prediction, frankly, came true recently. So the first slide is really more of a backdrop on the common elements of enforceability for a restrictive covenant. You need to have a protectable interest, which generally in most states is going to be a trade secret, something like a marketing formula or code. It could be in the food industry. It could literally be the way that you make, you know, turn vegetables into protein is a common thing now, if you've heard of the Impossible Burger, things like that. Or it could be customer lists and customer information. Those are two pretty common examples of a protectable interest. Then another common element of the enforceability of them is there no more restrictive necessary than to protect the interest. And there we're talking about reasonable time and geographical restrictions. And so, of course, almost always, if not every time I get one of these, the company wants to try to get a TRO and they want to try to get an injunction. And these are the elements in virtually every state to try to get a TRO or an injunction. And this is where the high points come in. A substantial likelihood of success on the merits, and just a teaser for the poll question, that is still a requirement. But a substantial likelihood of success on the merits, you have to show you have an inadequate remedy at law or irreparable harm. And what that means is money's not enough. They're going to hurt our goodwill. They're going to hurt our reputation. We can't quantify that. That's what that means. It's not against the public policy of the state to enforce the TRO or to enforce the restrictive covenant, and balancing the equities, waivers, and ways in favor of enforcing it. So pre-COVID, what courts really looked at were the first two elements and really at the inadequate remedy at law. That's the one element where courts oftentimes say, well, you have an adequate remedy at law. For example, if we're talking about a salesperson who leaves and takes a customer list and the former employer brings an action against the former employee for violating a non-compete or a non-solicit, then a great defense is, well, there's an adequate remedy at law. Money is enough, because if the former employee takes $100,000 worth of business, there's your damage. Don't enter an injunction. So these are the four elements, and they're all four still required. And as I said, pre-COVID, courts really looked at element one and two. And so I mentioned the prediction. What I started thinking around COVID is that courts are going to look at the public policy of the state, and they're going to balance the equities more. They're not just going to give it lip service. And so what we've seen come true is what I just said, that courts now are looking at elements three and four. They're looking at the public policy and they're balancing the equities. And previous to COVID, courts oftentimes would really give it lip service and say, well, there's a public policy of this state to honor contracts. And balancing the equities, usually they'd say the same thing. When you balance the equities, there's an equitable interest in protecting this confidential information. Just 2 weeks ago in the Eastern District of Pennsylvania, if you want to write this down, it's Schuylkill Valley Sports versus Corporate Images Company and Snyder. In that case, the plaintiff was a sporting goods retail company. One of the defendants was a former VP of sales for VP Sales. The defendant is laid off. As part of a layoff, goes to work for a competitor. So VP Sports tries to bring an action for tortious interference, for breaching the restrictive covenant, for misappropriation of trade secrets, and similar claims. And in the analysis, the court went through the four elements to receive a temporary injunction or preliminary injunction. And the court, so first, in all fairness, the court found that the restrictive covenant was not enforceable due to the fact that the person was laid off and there was a clause in the restrictive covenant that said that didn't count. But anyway, the court then looked at the third and fourth elements, and the court said that the equities favored the former employee because of stay-at-home orders, and also said In light of SVP's decision to lay off Snyder and of the fact they would be forced, he would be forced out of work when the country is facing the highest unemployment rates in more than seven decades, the public interest does not favor granting an injunction that would prevent him from working for the new employer. So what's the impact and what should we think about when we're thinking about trying to enforce restrictive covenants today? Of course, we got to look at the state law requirements because they're different in different states. But the case that I just mentioned highlights the importance of the least restrictive means necessary to protect information. We should review the agreements and thoughtfully analyze what you're really needing to protect and want to protect. You should itemize that information. You should look at the measures you've taken to protect that information. You want to make sure that the time and geographical restrictions are reasonable and look at any other factors such as whether there was a layoff or a furlough, or Andy mentioned earlier about reductions in pay. You need to consider those sorts of things before you think about trying to enforce a restrictive covenant, because it's going to be more difficult in these times to enforce a restrictive covenant, especially against somebody who was laid off or whose pay was reduced or a similar situation. It also gives us a good opportunity to go back and reevaluate the agreements we have in any event. Again, obviously, you want to look at the applicable state law because it varies among states. In Oklahoma, for example, you can't have a non-compete unless a person was an owner of the business. California is similar. Montana has unique laws. Louisiana has real particular laws. But also, and I talked about this pre-COVID, analyze and determine what really gives you a competitive advantage and resist the urge to list everything in your restrictive covenant agreements, because that's what the other side is going to focus on if you're trying to enforce it. Ensure that you have measures in place to protect the information. You don't just give it lip service, that you've thoughtfully restricted the time and geography. A big one for me and that we talk about is whether you really need a non-compete versus a non-solicit. If we're talking about a salesperson, you really usually can accomplish your goal by having a non-solicitation clause and not trying to prevent them from working at all. So the highlight would be, due to time, I'm going to mention it again, the highlight is even though all four elements are still required, the courts are going to focus more on the weighing of the balancing of the equities and the public interest. But again, all of those are required. And here is the poll question. And Ashley, after they've had enough time, I'll turn it back over to you.
Great, thank you. And while you guys are finishing up answering the question, just some closing statements that this concludes today's webinar. CLE certificates will be emailed within 48 hours directly to all who answered the polling question. A recorded version of the presentation will be available on the BLI website within 24 hours. Thank you for your participation.